Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
NATO, the air exercises over Germany, are a window on NATO in the conflict with Russia. The Russian attack failed to overwhelm either Ukraine or NATO, but the response now, more than a year into the war, is mixed. And I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News. He is the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy, as well as a visiting professor at Dickinson College in Keystone State. Jeff, I begin with NATO because the General Secretary, Jens Stoltenberg, visiting Washington, talking about his successor. There's a NATO meeting coming up in July. NATO has stood together these many months of conflict, and now that the counteroffensive is underway, NATO continues to pass arms and support and training into Ukraine. However, questions are raised about NATO's ambitions beyond Ukraine. For example, right now there's news that the Swedish application for NATO, accepted by all members, has not happened because of blocking either by Turkey or now Hungary. There's news that a Republican senator is looking to block arms sales to Hungary because of its blocking of Sweden. Your measure of NATO generally right now, does it surprise you for having held together without these disputes for a year? Or are you alarmed by what appears to be a ragged war effort against Russia? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Actually, I'm quite optimistic in many ways that NATO has hung together as well as it has for the last 15 or 16 months. And having worked in the White House on the National Security Council staff during the Kosovo crisis, which was much briefer, only 3 or 4 months, I can tell you that behind the scenes, keeping all countries of the alliance, now 30, heading in the same direction is a difficult proposition in the midst of a crisis. But it has done so and continues to provide military assistance to the alliance, to the Ukrainians, I should say. I think we're going to see some interesting developments in NATO, and you touched on several. One is we see the continuing desire to support Ukraine. That was underscored not only by Mr. Stoltenberg's visit to the White House, but prior to that, Prime Minister Sunak of Great Britain was at the White House with Joe Biden and underscored British support along with the president for Ukraine. Number two, though, we're going to have this upcoming summit, and I think that'll be a bellwether of NATO. You already mentioned, John, the selection of a new secretary general. But it seems to me in many ways, as we view NATO now in 2023, the center of gravity of NATO is shifting eastward. You and I, John, remembering the Cold War, know that the center of gravity in Europe, at least, was that tie between Bonn, Germany, the capital of West Germany, Paris, and London. And now that's moving eastward. And the countries like Poland, Baltic Republic, et cetera, are becoming much more outspoken in how they think the alliance may move ahead. We might well see, frankly, the next Secretary General coming from that particular part of the country.
My concern also about NATO is Sweden. That it was a gem of an addition, something that was unimaginable before. Well, I couldn't imagine it before the Ukraine war. The blocking seems to be political and seems to be on the basis of individual personalities. Mr. Erdogan in Turkey, who is now comfortably reelected to extend his 23 years of power, and Viktor Orban of Hungary, who is a maverick on this. Do you find these men's opinions ordinary, discordant, recognizable, solvable? How do you regard Erdogan and Orban for being not quite dissenters, but they're disruptors?
Yeah, certainly the case. Both are populists, and so therefore they want to demonstrate to their respective populations that they've extracted the most from the alliance for Hungary or Turkey, respectively, and agreeing to Sweden. Perhaps, I think, more of a concern in the Turkish case, Mr. Erdogan, going through a rather, for him, relatively close re-election campaign, but has talked an awful lot about so-called PKK Kurdish people who have departed Turkey now living in Sweden. He has demanded their extradition. Swedes have said we can't do that under Swedish law, and that's been kind of a sticking point. But at the same time, now we have in the United States Senate blockage not only to Hungary, but also the major sale of fighter aircraft to Erdogan. And so I think some kind of a deal will be worked out to assuage his concerns about Sweden in return for perhaps at least some of that military foreign military sales going ahead. But as we move up to the summit, that'll be the sort of the crunch point, and can, in fact, the Biden administration find a path to negotiate to get Sweden into the alliance? Because you're quite right, John. The entry of Sweden is extraordinary. As somebody once said, Mr. Putin, by his actions in a matter of a couple of weeks, undermined two centuries of Swedish neutrality. And Sweden and Finland are not insignificant military players at all, but bring about 250 high-performance combat aircraft alone into the alliance. And we have just this week a major NATO air exercise, Air Defender 2023, over the skies of Germany. But a lot of that exercise will also be over Poland, over the Baltic republics, sending a clear message to Mr. Putin of NATO's resolve, as well as NATO's military capabilities in the midst of this ongoing war in Ukraine.
Yes, Finland and Sweden. I think I've read that that makes it a Baltic, makes the Baltic a NATO lake. Do you agree with that, Jeff?
Without question. One only needs to look at the map of the Baltic and imagine back in the Cold War when Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania were part of the Soviet Union, and Poland and East Germany were part of the Warsaw Pact. And if you were a naval commander in, for the Soviet military in Kaliningrad or in St. Petersburg, Leningrad, you would have said that the Baltic was a Soviet lake. And then with the demise of the Soviet Union, the entry of the Balts into NATO, it became kind of a neutral sea. Well, if you look at the map now, the Baltic Sea now is surrounded by NATO countries with the arrival of Finland and hopefully Sweden. And if you're therefore the commander of this Russian fleet in Kaliningrad or in St. Petersburg, you know your chances of getting your fleet out of there in time of conflict are about zero. And so as a consequence, not only in terms of the military power, in terms of man and materiel that Sweden and Finland bring to the table for NATO, the geography, the geopolitics of this is really extraordinary with their entry into the alliance.
Two more details about NATO, and then we'll go to Ukraine. One is tactical, logistical. I'm surprised to learn that NATO had not standardized its ammunition. This item from Brussels, NATO Secretary Stoltenberg said that the transatlantic alliance needed to do more in terms of standardizing ammunition equipment. Since last fall, he says, we have been working on how to ramp up defense production. Standardization is a core responsibility. Jeff, was this discussed for your time in NATO, that the ammunition is not standardized? And why did they let it go? Because they thought the war was over? We were peace forever?
Absolutely, John. There were three areas of standardization that were always key and focused on, and that is fuel. Our vehicles and our aircraft operated under this with the same fuel. And even you could, you know, actually refuel a British or a German fighter aircraft, you know, that you, the hoses actually would fit into the fuselage to refuel the aircraft. So fuel. The second was ammunition. More on that in a second. And the third was radios, that we could talk to each other. And those were the three baselines of cooperation, standardization that we saw at NATO. As far as ammunition, the centerpiece was always on three things. That was the main tank gun was going to be 105 millimeters for many, many years in the Cold War. The standard artillery piece was going to be the 155 millimeter gun, different varieties of that, but the ammo would be the same. And 7.62 was going to be the standard NATO round for small arms. And we did a pretty good job of that during the Cold War and standardized our ammunition accordingly. But with the end of the Cold War, the belief that large-scale conventional hostilities were not going to occur, and frankly, some things that happened in the United States with the advent of the Abrams tank and whatever, we went to a 120-millimeter gun, and other countries started doing other things. And don't forget, of course, during the Cold War, we had massive stocks of conventional ammo in all those categories, small arms, artillery, and tank, all across, particularly Germany. Those were either brought back to the United States or disposed of when the Cold War came to an end. And as we've talked several times in our broadcast, John, the change in our industrial policy is clearly one of the overarching changes for the West, at least, which has been a derivative of this war in Ukraine. And that will continue, I would argue, even if this war was to come to a close today.
The strategic detail. The New York Times headline, "Allies pressure Biden to hasten NATO membership for Ukraine." We're also told by The Guardian that that will not happen in July. What is the advantage of bringing Ukraine in active conflict into NATO? That suggests a total confrontation. Is that, at this point, needed?
No, I don't think it's needed at all. And you're right. You know, this would include the Article 5 security guarantee as part of the NATO alliance, that an attack on one is an attack on all. So to bring Ukraine into the alliance right now would, in essence, be a declaration of war by NATO on the Russian Federation, because then a member would be under attack from an outsider, and therefore the collective defense guarantee under that treaty would go into effect. I think you'd have a very, very difficult time, oh, by the way, getting the United States Congress to agree to having Ukraine join NATO under those circumstances. But it does force us to think, and we need to do that, what happens the day this war is over? All wars come to an end, and then what happens then? And I've talked to a lot of Ukrainians and other members of the alliance, and we certainly need to think through what security guarantees can we offer Ukraine that will deter future aggression by Russia, even if this war was to come to a close soon, and dissuade them, the Russians, from recommencing this war. Some have talked about NATO membership, if an agreement on territory was reached with the Russian and formalized borders were created. Some have talked about a U.S. security guarantee that we offer Ukraine that's not terribly different from the guarantee we offer Japan or we offer Israel, for example, might be another mechanism to provide security guarantees to Ukraine. But we need to think that through, because clearly that's going to be one of the parts of the end of this conflict, if we're going to bring it to a conclusion and make sure it's not just a frozen conflict that could erupt at any moment in the future.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired artilleryman, CBS News, Dickinson College visiting professor, CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. We're headed to Ukraine, fog of war. I'm John Batchelor.